If you've lived in Iowa for long, it's a good bet that you're familiar with the work of Mike Pace. He's an actor, a television host, a radio host, a producer, and also a poet. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. You may know Mike Pace from the 20 years he hosted the Powerball lottery drawings on television, or the 3 decades he's been the host of the Iowa Realty Sunday Home Show in Central Iowa, and he now hosts a weekly radio show on KRNT. Today, you'll meet Mike Pace, the poet. He's just published his first collection of poetry called Dreams and Detours, reflecting on the souvenirs of a lifetime. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Mike Pace is one of Iowa's most recognizable media personalities. You may know him from the 20 years or so he hosted the Powerball lottery drawings on television, broadcast coast to coast, or from the 3 decades he's been the host of the Iowa Realty Sunday Home Show in Central Iowa, maybe from his weekly radio show on KRNT, or from countless other projects. And with me in the studio today, I have Mike Pace, the poet. He has just published his first collection of poetry called Dreams and Detours, reflecting on the souvenirs of a lifetime. Hello, Mike.
Charity, what a pleasure.
Well,
I've been looking forward
so
to this.
Nice
I really
have. Great. Well, all right. Let's start with poetry. Nobody probably guessed, watching you draw the numbers on the Powerball, that there was a poet inside that tuxedo.
Well, there was something hiding in there for a long time, actually, as it turns out. I've written 1,000 broadcast scripts over the years, 30 years in this business, lots of corporate video scripts, a couple of half-baked screenplays. But back in the back of my mind, I always knew that I would try to do this when the time was right, when things loosened up a little in my career. And I'm not traveling as much these days, so it's time. You know, it's just time to do it. And instead of creativity on demand, Mike, I need 2 60-second spots by 11 o'clock. I can do what's in here and take my time with it, you know.
Well, in the beginning of the book, you write about a time when you were 16 years old. You were in high school, and you were asked about what you wanted to be doing in 10 years. And what did you say?
Well, in that class, of all the dreams that each of us announced, mine probably were the least reasonable and the most exotic and unrealistic and naive and all the rest. Professional baseball player, jazz musician, or freelance writer. And, of course, none of that happened. And here I am trying to do the latter today.
Now, you grew up in Winterset and then high school in Norwalk.
Grade school and junior high in Winterset. My father was a teacher there. And then we moved to Norwalk for high school. That's where I met my bride.
All right. Well, and speaking of your bride, would you read a poem about your bride for us that takes us back to those days in Norwalk?
I would. Just to set it up a little bit, she was we were in the same class, and we were had the lead in both the junior and senior class plays, but there were 33 in our class, so the competition wasn't terribly difficult. But she was 17, and I was 15 as a junior.
Wow.
That's
a big gulf.
It certainly is. A girl matures quicker anyway, and I was a child and she was a woman. That's basically what it amounts to. But this was our beginning, I think, maybe, so I'll read. It's called Queen of the Marines. Never mind the vintage cars, the old tractors, cowboys on their Palominos, another out-of-tune high school band. There she was. How could a farmer's daughter at 17 be so tall and smooth and elegant? She was Jackie Kennedy in that Buick convertible, Queen of the Marines. The Navy Queen and Army Queen paled by comparison. In 61, no one came close. But I was 15. I didn't exist. I could barely make eye contact. She scared me so. And when we kissed in the junior class play, I thought my lungs would collapse. She didn't notice. Then she was off to New York to fashion design school, but at the last minute, couldn't go. She didn't say much, just something about farm and money problems. A sign from God. She would be mine after all. And as she tossed the bows aside one by one, I was always there, a little taller now and not quite so something. I wore her down, and when she married me, she knew little of the dreamer I was. She was my dream. Houses and towns, mostly to appease me, and then a son who had become the glue. And always she with her eyes straight ahead and I taking the scenic route. Somehow her broken dreams were mended, her regrets stowed away. Now she's a grandmother, Jackie Kennedy in that Chevy Blazer, tall and smooth and elegant, queen of the Marines.
It's Mike Pace reading from his new poetry collection, Dreams and Detours, reflecting on the souvenirs of a lifetime. And you did marry your high school sweetheart.
I did. We celebrated 49 years in August.
Congratulations.
Of course, you know, I always tell people we were 11, but they don't believe that.
And her name is Gail?
Gail Ann. Abigail, I call her. Yeah.
And you stuck pretty close to home as far as raising your son and wanting to be in Iowa. Why did you make that choice?
Well, the book's called Dreams and Detours, and there were some detours that started really in college at Central College where I met your father.
Right.
We played basketball together and then transferred to Iowa State where my father was on the staff and switched majors and dropped out for a year, got drafted, became an Army musician, trying to grab pieces of these dreams, you know. And there have been lots of detours, and hopefully they're mostly past now. But I'm not sure the original question. I was.
Why did you choose to be in Iowa?
Oh, well, we love Iowa, for one thing. I think we just finished a trip to the southeast part of the country. Savannah, Charleston, that area. And yes, the ocean is there and the mountains and the scenery and all the rest of it, but there's something really in my roots about Iowa. I'm just an Iowa guy. And in my early radio career, which was what I did fresh out of school, I wasn't ready for L.A. and frankly wouldn't live there if they gave me the place. So I really have an affinity for Iowa. I just like it. I love Iowa. And my career went from a little, student announcer at WOI.
You worked in public radio for a little while.
We talked
right?
about all the people we know in common.
Right. You used to work with Doug Brown and with Don Forsling.
Absolutely.
Jake Graves was your boss.
He was.
He was also my boss when I was a student at WOI.
And Doug Brown, what a master. I had to follow him once at a reading, I think, National Day of Reading or something at the library, and that was daunting, to say the least. But, yeah, we've traveled some, but my career has been in Iowa pretty much. I did jump out of the business for a while and chased the almighty dollar and the clothing business, the garment industry, and traveled a little in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the Midwest. And some of my work has taken me east and west. With video and television and that kind of thing, but always home to Iowa.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned playing basketball in college, you were also a baseball player, and you had dreams of going pro in baseball, right?
Well, but at 16, those
of course almost all boys.
I was going to say everybody
baseball.
I can remember had dreams of playing pro baseball or basketball or something, but and they were pretty unrealistic. But I've been able to play some baseball. I played in the Army. I played some semi-pro ball and what have you. And so, yeah.
Well, and your son was also a ball player. And could you read us Send Him to the Shade? We have a break coming up here in a minute, but I think we've got time for you to read that. It's on page 51.
51, sure.
And so your son also played baseball and also played basketball, right?
He's a big guy, and he played basketball in high school at Winterset, went to the state tournament a couple of times, and then recruited by Eldon Miller and went to UNI and played basketball there, and he's on the staff in the education department up there now. But I wrote this for him when he was a senior because he was a pitcher in baseball, as I was. And he always rolls his eyes when he hears this one. It's called Send Him to the Shade. The ghosts of curves and summer days, of popping mitts and pickoff plays, still roam the lonely diamonds where we played. Where moldy now with dust and time, the Kaline scorebooks, theirs and mine, tell of guts and steam and records that we made. Let them think you're a little mean, standing there hard and lean, and keep it low and give them hell. There's history being made. For now it's you and your tall frame to leave your mark on this great game, to stretch and throw and send them to the shade.
That's Mike Pace reading Send Him to the Shade from his new collection, Dreams and Detours. And was that his senior year in high school or senior year in college that you wrote that?
Senior year in high school. Yeah.
So he was of an age where maybe having dad write a poem for him wasn't exactly.
Wasn't all that cool and maybe still isn't.
He'll get there. So what do you think? You know, a lot of people, you know, and you played ball with my dad at Central College. A lot of people have those dreams and are really driven in sports. Do you feel that served you in some way as you were getting started in your career, or was it almost a distraction?
No, I think I began to put it in place fairly soon, you know, realizing those dreams just are not going to be fulfilled. And I was able to do some of it, as I say. No, I think the experience with sports is mostly good. I question some of the direction that things are going these days. But, you know, the competition life is about competition, and I think that's good, and the team aspects and the cooperation and so on that go along with sports, I think it was all good.
Well, these days there's a lot of talk about student athletes and whether it's possible in college to be a student athlete.
Exactly.
And your son obviously thrived, and he now has his PhD and he's a professor.
Exactly.
But do you see that struggle? Did you see him struggle with that when he was in school?
No, I think Nick was always a, you know, the definition of a student athlete. I mean, he had a wonderful grade point, and he's published 4 books now. And he never was, I guess I can throw this around and not be too disparaging, he was never a jock. He was an athlete, but a student athlete.
Well, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. I'm talking with Mike Pace, and today we're talking about poetry, although we'll talk about many, many other things this hour as well. And as Mike was just telling me before the show started, he thinks he's met everybody in Iowa once. So if you have a question you'd like to ask or something you'd like to share, you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mike Pace, probably best known from the Powerball lottery drawings or the Iowa Realty Sunday Home Show, has just published his first collection of poetry. It's called Dreams and Detours, reflecting on the souvenirs of a lifetime. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Mike Pace, who is one of Iowa's most recognizable media personalities. Today, he's here with us to talk about poetry. He's just released his very first collection of poetry. It's called Dreams and Detours, Reflecting on the Souvenirs of a Lifetime. And this hour, we're doing some reflecting. We're looking back over a long career and a lot of interesting different parts of media. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So I know that you got your start in local radio, WOI radio, just like I did.
Right.
And then you went a few different directions in radio, and then you went into the clothing industry. And, you know, making a living is important for all of us. What brought you back into media?
I think I knew fairly soon, although, you know, I was certainly enamored with doubling or tripling my income. There were days there in radio when I was playing in a band 2-3 nights a week, working at a clothing store selling shirts part-time, and a full-time radio job trying to make a living. And so the clothing industry was pretty lucrative. and an abundance of legitimate time off and had a lot of perks. But I knew pretty soon that I couldn't do that for 30 years, that I needed to be involved in some kind of creative atmosphere. And so 7 or 8 years of that, with very little dabbling, I kind of turned the corner and tried to do it. And it didn't work. And I, 37, I made a major career change and went back to almost nothing. Gave up a really good job and took a 6 to midnight Sunday night shift for $6 an hour.
That must have been scary.
Yeah. And probably more scary for Gail, who stayed with me through all that. We spent our savings and scratched and clawed and auditioned, and a few things happened. And
so what drove you? Why was, I mean, that is a big risk to take, and I'm sure you were scared. What was so compelling about being in this line of work that made you want to take that leap?
I don't know. I think it's because it's so much closer to who I really am and what my talents are and what my what makes me feel good. I need a creative conquest now and then of some kind, you know. The music, the language were the only two academic areas where I really had much in the way of chops. And so, you know, I've been able to dabble in those in this business, and it feels like home.
Well, and tell me a little bit about music. You've brought that up several times. It makes an important entrance into a number of your poems. What do you play?
Well, I was a trombonist, and I say was pretty much past tense because the horn is in the case, has been for a long time. And I was a singer, and I've written some songs, nothing that you're going to hear on Top 40 radio, that's for sure. But I think it was my first love or second love right after the Queen of the Marines. And I guess those dreams went away fairly soon because that's such a huge commitment if you want to do that. And I really didn't want to teach. I thought I wanted to perform. Well, that's a tough go.
Right. Well, and even your radio show on KRNT Today is mm-hmm. described as eclectic. You seem to have a lot of varied musical interests.
I do, and I have such luxury on this radio show because KRNT gives me the hour, allows me to play and say pretty much anything I want to do, which is pretty hard to find in radio
yes.
these days. And so I play some blues, some jazz, some pop music that's not going to be heard every day on the radio. I have occasional guests. I throw some opinions around, and we do some fun bits. My engineer is a very good friend, and he helps me with some things, and we do some recorded silly stuff occasionally. And it's very eclectic. Never know. The other day I did a segue from Dvorak to, I think it was John Fogerty. Now, you know, that's a scary concept, but we pulled it off.
Nice. Well, you are welcome to join our conversation. I'm talking with Mike Pace today, and you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Rick is on the line in Norwalk. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I have the privilege of having worked with Mr. Pace over the years. And first of all, Mike, I know you're aware of this, but I don't know if you know that statue they erected of you throwing that 53-mile-an-hour fastball down at Norwalk when they built the new field, it went. I'm sorry, but that's the breaks of game, I guess. But
this is a friend of mine, Rick Elkin from Norwalk, Iowa, the town too tough to die. And Rick, it's nice to hear from you. Did you have a legitimate question, or should we go on to a real listener?
Well, and I just wondered, are you going to share some of your famous limericks with the audience today, or will we have to come to your private?
I think that might happen Friday night if you're around. But
no, I'm tickled to death that you have done this, and I'm anxious to hopefully be there on Friday evening to go and listen to your poetry. I've enjoyed what they've shown or talked about so far, and the couple that you've done, and I loved the Queen of the Marines. It was just wonderful. So good luck with everything.
Rick, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Rick, thank you very much. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And you do play around, no limericks in the collection, but you do play around with form quite a bit. You've written a number of sonnets. And what excites you about trying out different kinds of poetry?
Well, I think it may be that I simply may not have a definitive style. I mean, I've dabbled in some of this. Some of these go back 20, 30 years, or a couple of them maybe even longer. But most of them have been written in the last 10 or 12 years, I suppose, and some in the last months. But, you know, Robert Frost said writing poetry without rhythm and rhyme is like playing tennis without a net. You know, that's one school of thought. Then if we could switch to a music idiom and talk about Miles Davis, he gave up key signatures. He even gave up time signatures in some of the experimental stuff he did. Total freedom. If he pushed the valve and blew through the mouthpiece, it was cool. I mean, that's the other extreme. And so I've done some sonnets, which are a very difficult exercise, but they make you dissect every syllable. It's very challenging, but a great exercise. And there's some rhythm and rhyme, like Send Him to the Shade, mm-hmm. and there's some free verse, and there's some short stories and a little bit of everything in this book. And it may be that I'm just not established enough or don't know myself well enough to know what I do well. That might be it.
Well, you wrote one for your dad, and unfortunately it's too long for us to read here today. But at the very beginning of it, you said your dad would have preferred if this one rhymed. Was there any push and pull there between you and your dad and literature that you enjoyed?
No, not really. My dad was French and Spanish professor and taught English and was a writer and was very encouraging to me and complimentary about the things I did. And the last couple of days of his life, he died within 6 weeks of my mother's death a couple of years ago. We spent the afternoon reading poetry, and he knew most of the poets, and he'd finished the poem, and it was pretty daunting. It really was. But he encouraged me, and I think he understood the free verse thing and so on, even though he might have preferred some of the classics.
Well, and you say that your dad was the guy who made you believe you could do anything.
Yeah, it's an interesting, complicated relationship we had in terms of putting him on such a pedestal that I believed it literally when he said I could do anything I wanted to do, and it made settling a little difficult. Because it took me a while to realize, well, maybe he didn't mean that in such literal terms, you know. But I think it was great because he encouraged me to shoot for the moon.
Well, and when you made that big career left-hand turn when you were 37 mm-hmm. years old, was he encouraging then as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Even though you had a wife to support and a little boy to feed? And
yeah, no, that was a scary time, but I knew deep down that it was the right move. And if I die tomorrow, I know it was the right move.
Well, and I mentioned earlier a couple of the things that you are known best for. You've done many, many projects over the years, and you've talked about how the need for creativity has driven you. Now, hosting Powerball drawings may not be the biggest creative outlet for a lot of people. How did that happen? I mean, you started out with the Iowa Lottery. Right?
I'm sure that a lot of people think I am a fluff ball, and that's, you know, there may be some little something in the back of my mind that says, I want to show people that I can do more than read numbers. You know, there might be a little of that going on. But that was a cattle call. It was a audition. It was lucrative. It was great for my career in terms of recognition. And when you're a freelance independent contractor, your future is based on the next phone call and the next gig.
Right.
And it was a good one.
And it lasted 20 years.
23 years.
23
yeah.
years.
It was a good one.
And where did that take you? I mean, certainly we all knew your face. Everyone who grew up in Iowa, the time that I grew up in Iowa, we all knew Mike Pace.
Well, you know, I try not to gratify my ego by being recognized because you can really get your feelings hurt, you know? About the time I say this often to people when we talk about this, If you think everybody knows you, the guy at the Quick Trip never heard of you. So don't go there. You're just asking for trouble. And, you know, I would be surprised on both ends of the spectrum. I'd be in Denver and somebody would say, aren't you the guy on TV? Or I'd be 10 miles from my hometown and nobody knows who you are. So it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. But I was able to travel and did some things for state lotteries all over the country. And that was a bit of an entree or a stepping stone to some other things. But my local things in Des Moines were the Iowa Realty Connection, and some of the other clients that I've had over the years have been equally important to me. And I've been very fortunate.
Well, and as I mentioned, I mean, you've been all over the place, and you've been in plays, and you've done other creative acting gigs. You've received awards for your film work. There have been a lot of other projects over the years. But when you do something like the Realty Show or like the Iowa Lottery or even a commercial for somebody, is there something of yourself that you try to bring to that performance?
I think first of all, I try to work with really good people, really good companies, and I've been fortunate in that area. And so I believe in what my clients, for the most part, what my clients are all about. I'm not going to represent somebody that I don't feel good about. And I think if I have an asset in terms of a spokesperson, it is a certain sincerity maybe that comes through because of that, because I think, at least I've been told, that I don't look like a phony baloney. People kind of believe what I say. And that's a real compliment, and that's an asset if it's true. Yeah.
So have you had to walk away from projects that were offered you?
Oh, yes. Lots of them.
Dollar signs
in my eyes.
Right. In those early years, that must have been a difficult choice to make.
Well, there are certain products I could never endorse, alcohol or tobacco and things like that. But beyond that, there were companies that I didn't feel had the credibility and the, you know, the kind of virtues that I'm looking for in partners.
Is this something that you'd bring home and you and Gail would talk about it?
Absolutely. Gail has been and will always be my best critic, worst, toughest critic, but also my best counselor about those things. I don't think this would be good for you, Michael. You don't need to do this. But look how much money they're going to pay me. We've had those conversations.
Yeah. Well, you work in a visual industry much of the time, and I want to talk a little bit about the photographs in this collection. These are not photographs that you took.
No, they sure are not.
Who did you collaborate with? Let's talk about him.
Well, this is really interesting because the book began as an idea of an inexpensive paperback book of mostly poems and maybe a few short stories. And Gail suggested that I collaborate with my good, good friend from high school, Mike Wetland, who he was the catcher, I was the pitcher, he was the halfback, I was the quarterback. We played in the band together. We won the Bill Riley competition in a little band back in 19, I think it was. And he's a wonderful photographer, and he lives in Minneapolis, and we've been 50-year friends. And so the thing evolved from this simple book of poems to a kind of a coffee table worthy hardcover book with beautiful, beautiful photography.
Yeah. Well, and did he specifically take these photographs for your poems, or did you work together to select from photos that he already had?
We did both. Several of them were done especially for this, and several were on his website and in his collection. But the other thing that Michael did to take this to the next level was he basically did the design of the book. And we were a little high maintenance, I think, for Pioneer Graphics are great people, and they did a wonderful job for us. But we knew what we wanted in terms of the look, the font, the layout, the colors, the background, all. And Michael really is almost individually responsible for all that. And I just think he did a great job. And we worked really hard at finding a photograph that subtly, in many cases, sort of embellished the words.
Is there a favorite pairing that you have? Is there one in the book that really stands out?
Oh, that would be hard. That would really be hard. The Red Bridge, which is a Japanese bridge, I believe, in Minneapolis that Michael took, that goes with my father's piece is one, but as you mentioned, that's a little too long to read today. There's one that talks about the death of both of my parents. And I want to make sure that people don't think this is all heavy and dark. It's serious, most of it, but a lot of it ends positively, and this is an example of that. There's a photograph of two swings in the snow, empty swings. And the poem, or the piece, is called 6 Weeks, and it's about my mother and father. Should I read that?
You know what? Let's read it when we get back from
Perfect.
Our break.
Perfect.
That'll be great. There are not photos that accompany absolutely every poem in the book, although there are most of them do seem to have
right.
a match. And I was struck by the real variety of the pictures that you and Michael certainly stretched your hands far in looking for images that would enhance the poetry.
Well, there's some variety in what he does. He's beginning to play a lot with layering and texture and abstracting some of his photographs. And there's some of that here, but a lot of traditional stuff.
I'm talking with Mike Pace. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. The book is called Dreams and Detours, Reflecting on the Souvenirs of a Lifetime. It's Mike Pace's very first collection of poetry to be published, although clearly he's been writing poetry for many, many years, along with all of the other things he's been doing. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Mike Pace, one of Iowa's most recognizable media personalities. And we're not talking lottery numbers today. We're talking about poetry today. He has just written his first poetry collection, just published his first poetry collection called Dreams and Detours, Reflecting on the Souvenirs of a Lifetime. And Mike, right before the break, we were talking about a poem that you wrote about, and again, to reiterate, not all of the poems in this book are about people that you've lost or the feeling of loss. There are some bright moments as well, but this is a poem that you wrote about your parents.
I dedicated this book to my mother and father. I could read the dedication quickly. I dedicate this book to my mother and father, Dr. Floyd and Betty Pace, who died within 6 weeks of one another in 2011, the linguist and the librarian, who gave me, among so many other things, my love of words. And again, I do want to make sure that people aren't looking for razor blades when they read this, but this is called 6 Weeks. 6 weeks, both gone. I won't see them again, or hug them, or kiss them. But I feel their presence, their ideas, values, opinions, their quirks, their idiosyncrasies. I'm not sure what immortality means, but their mark is on me. I will take their lessons of tolerance, fair play, and kindness, their reverence for nature and the spiritual, refine them, sculpture them, and leave them for my son. Maybe that's what it means.
This book, there are a number of poems that are written for people who have passed, and you're also giving proceeds from this book to hospice. Tell me a little bit about why hospice is so important to you.
Well, I think when the book evolved from the simple paperback to what's now a hardcover, color photographs, and so on, we decided that maybe we should try to do something with this to benefit somebody. Gail is a volunteer with HCI Hospice Care Services and Planned Parenthood, very dedicated volunteer. And so we chose HCI because she has been there for 25 years, and her mother died back in 1987 and received wonderful hospice care from a nurse who was as close to a saint as I've ever met. And then 20 years later, her father had the same nurse when he died. So hospice it so impressed us that she was inspired to take the training and become a volunteer. And so it was a logical charitable organization that we maybe could benefit in a modest way. Hopefully, the awareness that I can create as I run around the state reading will be as important or more than the modest financial gift that I'm sure that they'll receive. But, I think these caregivers are special people. And I spoke to a group of them a few weeks ago, and they're, along with doctors and law enforcement people and a select few others, they can make a difference on a daily basis in people's lives. And so we feel strongly about hospice in general, and this is a nonprofit organization, and we think that's important. So that's where that came from.
Would you read another one for us? And this gives us an idea. It's called Last Verse. And again, I mean, there are lighthearted moments.
Well,
in
and
this
I think but... even though virtually everything in the book is fairly serious, it isn't all dark because a lot of things end on a very positive note. This is one of them, I think. It is October in my life. I watch a parade of departing parents and loved ones, each singing a personal last verse of the song of life. Most will make a slow and burdensome exit, exhausting body, mind, and caregivers. Oh, to be among the fortunate few to take a grateful brief bow. And as the andante yields to the largo, suddenly life is sweeter, home more dear. Days that went uncounted are cherished, moments shared more poignant. With the winter comes the fine. So before the moments become a precious few, taste and savor the sweetness in October.
How does it feel to be sharing something so personal with such a broad audience now, having done the put on a tuxedo and look good and the more, I guess, shallow interactions? How does it feel to really bare your soul like this?
Well, you know, Jim Autry, who's a friend of mine, and he's published 10 books of poetry and an amazing man, told me early on that if you're going to write, you got to lay it out there. You know, if you want to get to the good stuff, you've got to bear it and lay it out there and be vulnerable. And that's the first step, and I have at least been able to do that. Whether there's anything else that occurs here communication-wise or not, I don't know. But I have found that I'm willing to do that. And I think whether you're 18 or 81, there's some things here about life and family and love and loss and death. And that's what life is all about. Those are the biggies. And if you're willing to think seriously about those, then this book is for you.
Michael is on the line from Maxwell. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm a longtime listener to Mike's radio program, and I've noticed over time that he, there's a certain kind of civility and a kind of, I guess I could call it an old-fashioned charm and civility that is just you don't hear it that much on the radio anymore, and I really appreciate that. I was reading yesterday something about poetry. Only a poet can discern poetry in the commonplace prose of routine existence, and I think Mike does that wonderfully well, and conveys a civility that we just don't hear too much anymore, and I just want to thank you for that.
Michael, those are nice words. Thank you very much. You know, I admire Ted Kooser and Jim Autry, who I think both do that extremely well, and I like the flowery language of the classic poets and so on and so forth. But I also admire the succinct approach of contemporary people, and a simple scenario can have metaphor and can have meaning and depth when it's in the hands of a writer like those guys. And to throw my name around with them is a little presumptuous, but thank you, Michael.
Michael, thank you so much for your call. And with a return to radio, is that another place where you feel like you get to be authentic and get to be the real Mike Pace?
Yeah, I think so. As I say, they've given me such freedom at KRNT over there to talk about anything I want to talk about. I'll get political occasionally. I'll get we do silly stuff, as I mentioned. And the music is whatever I want it to be within. I mean, I'm not going to play certain things because I don't like them, although I don't know that they would say I couldn't. So that's it's a luxury. And, yeah, I think each week the show is some weeks terribly different from the last. But it's me. I'm laying it out there on the radio every week. Monday at noon, Sunday night at 9 on KRNT.
when you meet people who appreciate your work, like Michael, I mean, how do you feel about your relationship with, let's say, your listeners, as opposed to maybe people who just say, hey, that's Mike Pace? But do you feel that there's a real bond with some of the people who you spend time with on the radio?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are a lot of choices, you know, from Sirius Radio and...
I'm painfully aware of all the choices
you are.
That are out there.
I'll bet you are, and all the other spots on the dial. But there must be a reason that they relate to something I say or play or do on the radio, and that's... You know, we don't know what the size of that audience is, but I know it's a quality audience. Yeah. As is yours.
What brought you back to radio?
I think it's a way to, it's a couple of things. I always loved radio, but radio changed. And the freedom that I talk about is pretty much gone for the most part. And I think there's a place for, this is an old format. I've fallen into some old habits that I stole and borrowed from people that used to do this 30, 40, 50 years ago. And there's a place for something that's different like that, where you might actually have a serious thought or have some fun and laugh and slap your leg, you know. But you don't have to be gross and crude about it, as a lot of radio is nowadays, and that's important to me. So, yeah, I think it's a great forum. I love it every week.
Back to the poems that are in this collection, a number of them are written for people who in your life who you've lost, and then a number of them are written for people in your life who are still with you. You read the one you wrote, one of the ones you wrote for your son and one that you wrote for your wife earlier. When the people who you have lost were in your life, were you able to say these things to them when they were still with you?
Yeah. I think it's really important. And I think my wife, Gail, has learned so much about the last chapter of life with her experience with hospice. Don't hide from it. This is life. This is part of life, the last chapter. And again, I don't want people to think the entire book is about life's last chapter, because it isn't. But we need to communicate. Patients and doctors, families and patients, families and doctors, siblings, family, you know, we need to say the things that are there and not wish we did.
It takes
and
some
I've been
courage.
Able to do that. It does take courage. Yeah.
Was that something that was part of your family culture?
I probably pushed that envelope along with my sister. There wasn't a lot of...
I mean, Iowans are famous for their reticence.
Yes. Yes. There wasn't a lot of... verbalizing of the love word and so on at home. I mean, we got hugs and we knew we were loved and all the rest. But I think Kathy and I, my sister, probably began to do that verbalizing and just made them like it, you know?
I would love for you to, before we run out of time, read the very last poem in the collection, because I think it speaks to saying I love you even if it's not something you really... say, because this sort of arose, it's a lovely, serious poem, but it arose out of a joke that you have with your son. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is kind of fun. I began years ago, whenever I would get on an airplane and go somewhere to work or on vacation or whatever, I would write a list of songs and music that I wanted played at my funeral. And it was kind of half serious, and I'd send it to my son, Nick, And it became kind of a tradition. And, of course, the music changed and so on and so forth. I do think I do think that if there's a service for your funeral or your death, it ought to be what you want it
right.
to be.
Right, you should be able to pick the
it
music.
It should be a reflection of you. And I've been to a few that weren't that way. And so I sent this list to Nick when I jump on a plane, and it's called If the Plane Goes Down. If the plane goes down, tell them he tried. He tried to be the right kind of husband, to love, support, and encourage her to be who she is. He tried to be the right kind of father, to show him where to look, but not what to see. He tried to be the right kind of friend, to be tolerant, to listen and laugh, confide and console. Tell them he tried to be the right kind of man, searching for his own truth among the roles he played. Tell them, and then play the music.
When you started that tradition of sending that list to your son, was there a part of you that thought, okay, if the plane goes down, I do want there to be a last happy interaction? Was there a serious kernel to that joke?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I think he knows that music is such a big part of my life, and the kind of music I want played on that particular day would be meaningful to me and hopefully remind them of something of me in that moment.
Now, this is not – you're not entering your last chapter, so I don't want this to sound like I'm sending you off into the sunset. But when you look back over a very full career, what are you most proud of?
I guess I'm most proud of finding an arena where I think I had something to offer and trying to do things as well as I could and treat people the way I like to be treated. That sounds awfully Pollyannish or simplified, but I think that's what it comes down to, trying to do things right.
What is left? What do you want to keep doing? Because now you're at that point in life where you kind of, clearly this poetry collection is a reflection of that. You get to make some choices.
Well, I'd like to continue with the radio show, hopefully for a while. If I can keep my voice sounding like I'm not Walter Brennan, I think I can still do radio for a while. But Gail and I are talking about another book. She's an artist, and we have written Christmas stories for our grandkids for about 10 years. And we're thinking maybe I would polish some of those up and make them a little more generic and then write some new ones, and she would illustrate the children's book. So I think that might be on the horizon. We want to travel. I just got back from a wonderful trip to Savannah and Charleston, that area, and there's some more of that we want to do. And we want to chase grandkids around.
You got two of them?
I have two teenage grandkids who are at Cedar Falls. One's a senior in high school, one's a freshman. And
lots of games to go to. And
lots of dance recitals and ball games, yeah. Yeah. It's all good.
Is there a... And as I said, I'm not sending you off into the sunset, but to people who are at your point in life, do you have a message about the fact that it's not too late to try some new things?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's that old saying that you only live twice, which is either laughable or may not be laughable to you. And it isn't too late. I waited a long time to do a couple of things. I made major career change at 37, and this project at 68. So go for it.
Mike Pace, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mike Pace's new poetry collection is called Dreams and Detours, reflecting on the souvenirs of a lifetime. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.